Accession number 17626, Thomas Lawton, Reel 9.
Mr. Lawton, Reel 9. You were describing an incident with the RSM, Mr. Lawton.
Yes. This was just after we got to France. While the battalion was moving, actually, to their various positions in Frevant and Dunk and so forth, and everybody had had instructions, water bottles will be filled. We had been had used to walking with water bottles empty. And this man, of course, the RSM had gone round, happened to touch this bottle, empty. And he blew up in the air to this lad. And the lad just didn't know what he was being told off for. Later on, when the RSM was telling some other sergeant majors about this incident, I said, "Excuse me, sir. There's only one reason why that lad's water bottle wasn't filled. He didn't know where the tap was." "But everybody else was going to the tap." I says, "Yes. But," I says, "the man you're referring to," I says, "is slow." I says, "you've practically got to fill his water bottle for him." But I says, "there's no necessity whatsoever to make sure of it." And this was on the train. Four of us in the compartment. And I accused him of trying to make a big show of nothing. In other words, he wasn't a regimental sergeant major, in my opinion. He was just a fella that was blowing off steam. Because I was brought up by a father and mother in a family who I never saw anybody kiss each other in the house. We wished her the happy Christmas and that, but we weren't in the position where you could give presents to each other. But there was a lot of love in that house, although my father was a hard man. But he would not stand for unfairness. And unfairness meant taking advantage either of your position or taking advantage of another man's situation. You must be firm and fair. And my father told me, spoke those words many, many years ago. And I always thought, right, to be a good sergeant major, I've got to be firm and fair. And this is what I told the regimental sergeant major. You are neither firm nor fair, because you can be finicky at times. Right? And I've always believed in that. Be firm, but be fair. And don't speak to a man in a language he doesn't understand. Speak to him in his own language so that he understands. And then you say, "Do you understand what I'm saying?" If he says, "No, not quite," you say, "Right." Explain to him if necessary. But you must get down off your high horse and speak to the man at his level.
Looking back at those men who came into the ballroom, having lived at home, work, children, the normal things of life, and suddenly be faced with a war, an army, they must have had, in your opinion, certain needs that you felt you had to, because you're the first man they met.
Absolutely. The first man they met, of course, would be the sergeant who brought them in. But he was just bringing them in. But the first person they met who was going to look after them was me. I was the big chief. And as I say, I got them a good feed that night. They got a blanket, a suit, two blankets. I went up onto the veranda, the veranda we had, and I looked down at about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I thought, poor souls. There's engineers among them. There's skilled men among them. There's labourers among them. There's men that have been digging holes all their life. And I just lying there, last night they would go to bed at home. Today, a new world. And it was my opinion that I must even mother them if necessary. So, when we get a stupid song called Sergeant Major, Be a Mother to Me, and we laughed at it, that's exactly the situation. Kiss me goodnight, Sergeant Major. Took me in my little wooden bed. Kiss me goodnight, Sergeant Major. Diddle, diddle, diddle. Be a mother to me. That's it. Firm, fair, and mother them if necessary. Because they're going to be your children if it, when it comes to push. And I never knew any of them got into trouble. If we had a man who, like I did have two men for courts martials in France, one never got there. I found him with me when I had 25 men left. And I said, what are you doing here? He says, I never got his man. I says, right, I should take that rifle off you. And he was disgusted with me for thinking that I thought he might shoot us in the back.
We'll come to that, of course, later in the story of France. So these men, as you say, you were, in a sense, mothering them. You were a father confessor. Did they come with their problems to you? Was that the relationship that you built up?
No, but they did come to ask, what will I do with my car? What will I do? He's got some money. What will I do with the money? And my answer was very simple. See, the CQMS, that's the company quartermaster sergeant, he deals with all that, right? And he will advise you wisely.
Can we look at some of the men you've mentioned? Some of the men you had. There would be an officer in command overall down there.
Well, you see, with the militiamen, you had the officer in charge, who was a lieutenant. We never had anything higher than the lieutenant. And they, in turn, it might have been a bank. It might have worked in a bank or something like that. See. He had the authority, but sometimes they didn't have the, what we call, malum. They didn't have that common touch, which Kipling used to talk about, right? And they would ask you, more or less, what should I do? Right? And you told them what you thought they should do in their position. And I would say, well, if I was in your position, sir, what I would do would be such and such, right? Always bearing in mind that we're dealing with military personnel and we've got to carry out in a military manner the rules and laws of the military command. The men themselves never seemed to have any trouble. They got back into the billets in time at night time. Never had any drunken carry-on. And I think some of those lads really would be living like they were at home, only they weren't at home. They didn't have a mother to look after them, but I think they thought they had a sergeant major to look after them. And I did. So I used to talk. There was a club right opposite the ballroom. There was a club, still in Chester Street. And I said, pop in there for a pint of beer. The result was, of course, the barman came along and said, what do you want this time, Sergeant Major? I said, I don't want to. Why, there's one there for you. These lads, when they saw you in the pub, they just wanted to show appreciation. They would send you drinks. So I got them on parade, and I said, no, listen, fellas, I appreciate your kindness, but remember this, if you will persist in sending me a drink, I'll have to stop going to that club. I cannot drink with you because of my rank. I said, I'll not be able to go into the club because you are standing me beer, and that is not allowed for the ranker to stand the sergeant major a drink. So it happened, just so long as they knew. And that was my, all the time, if a man doesn't know that it's wrong to do that, he's likely to do it. So you tell him the right way, and you show him the right way, and you explain. And you see, we had officers who used to say, remember, when you go on leave, remember, your people are proud of you in that uniform. Don't let them down. That's nice. Don't let them down. If they didn't let them go, they wouldn't let us down. And this is one thing I did appreciate about officers. They seemed to realize that these fellas knew less than themselves. Aye, about army life, but not about civvy street. And as I say, we had engineers, we had lads who were very clever, we had artists, people who would sit down and do a sketch, you know. And, of course, the other fellow who said, that isn't a bushy top tree, that is an apple tree. He believed that. So we had to take him to it, agree with him. Yes, it's an apple tree. But you're the only man in the army that knew that is an apple tree. As far as we're concerned, it's a bushy top tree. That's a hedgerow, and that is a pine tree or a fir tree. Ah, we only have three trees. Well, of course, being a countryman, he knew trees and everything, but he agreed. He agreed to finish. And we found that if you would talk to them, talk with them, and explain, and say, do you understand? Yes. You sure do. I know some people say to me, Sam, why do you bother? Why? Why do I bother what? You know, him. Why do you bother with him? Because he's the fella I want to be bothered with. Because I want him to be as good as him. And so get me, waste me time on him. He knows it all. Not this fella. But I want him to be as good as him.
After 8 weeks, where had they got to in the training? After 8 weeks?
In the 8 weeks, they had fired the course. They had gone through weapon training, the assembling that of the different weapons. They had been taught the various movements in drill. Eight weeks intensive training meant they wanted you to produce a man that looked like a soldier and acted like a soldier and moved like a soldier, which we did. But any training other than that was what they got when the ones got the battalion. Like a carter took them over, you know, and they would show them. For instance, we would sometimes get men come in, regulars, a carter of 8 men, to show them how to do certain movements, you see. And of course, with them being regular soldiers, they were very precise, and the men... One thing we cut out, the stamping of that foot. Cut that out. Not necessary. If you want to be a guardsman, etc., by all means do it. But infantrymen, and all we want you to do is to stand correctly to attention, move to attention, but cut out any extreme noise, especially the swinging of the arms. The arms swing to belt level. Don't want it up there. We just want it to belt level. And if you put the belt level, you can practically swing it the same distance back. So you get an even movement. None of this stupid way they're throwing the arms in the air. Just a straightforward march, swinging the arms, stepping out correctly, 30-inch pace. What? 30-inch pace. That's why we've got to pace the stick. Show you the 30 inches. We used to show them that. And they used to practice it, you know. But the object was to give them military training as quick as possible to turn a man out who could go to the battalion and be taken over, absorbed in the battalion as a fighting man if necessary, because he had all the qualities in him to start with. You don't have to embroider a man a fighting quality. Once you put him in a fighting position, he becomes a fighter. And maneuvers. We didn't get any maneuvers with these lads, but we used to have plenty of landscape targets and used to use those targets for pointing out various targets and methods of shooting at the target or approaching a target. I would think an outstanding example was the very man I was talking about, the brigade major, Fillingham, the mad major, who sent for me at the double to his office, and I reported in, banged one up, and he said, What do you think of those sandwiches? That was a couple of sandwiches then. Very nice, sir. He had some stockings pulled over his putties. He said, you see, this is improvisation. Keep my putties clean. And I dare say to him, aye, but if I did that, you would shoot me down. Eh? So he said to me, we have an army, we have an American military attaché here, and I want you to take your company of militiamen down the ropey road to what we call the drain pipe field. Yes, sir. You'll be on observation, but I won't tell you where from. Uh-huh. And he says, I want to impress this man. Right. Got the lads together, and I told him. I says, remember, you're under observation. And we marched down the ropery, changed arms if necessary, marched with the trail, changed arms, a bit swank. Went onto the drain pipe field, did a few maneuvers, such as controlled bayonet charge, and walking over the drain pipe and half of them slipping off it. So we had to go down and scrub it before we went there, see? And the brigade major told me later, wonderful show. The American found it very difficult to believe that those lads had only had so many weeks training. Because he says, they went down there like guardsmen. Exactly. And that was our job, to turn out a soldier if it was only to look at, because we knew we had it in him naturally.
Where did Captain Muscroft come in at this time?
Well, when I first went to A Company in Durham.
Is this after you've done your 8 weeks?
Oh, yes.
Oh, well, we'll come to that now. I thought maybe it might have been no. When you were at 8 weeks. So after some about 10 weeks, after going to Lambton with the the men you were training, you were then moved over to...
Then I was promoted to company sergeant major.
What time would this be?
Well, this could be about a month before we moved to France. And we went to France in the April.
And had you been moved from the 8th to the 11th battalion at this point in time?
Oh, I'm with the 11th then.
You're with the 11th
Yes,
now.
Yes. Oh, yes, I'm with the 11th.
And this was the battalion that was formed out of the excess...
This was a sister battalion to the 8th battalion, in the same way as the Tyneside Scottish, which was the 8th Black Watch, was a feeder to the Black Watch.
9th battalion.
9th battalion became Tyneside Scottish, who in turn with the 8th Black Watch or something like that. So that's why they wore the Thomas Shanders, you know. Well, this 11th battalion was a sister battalion to the 8th, the object being, of course, to be a feeder battalion, as the 8th wanted more men.
Had they creamed off the best? What were the standard of 11th, these 11th battalion men like?
You see, to go to the 11th battalion, to go to A Company of the 11th battalion, I was going to be a battalion that was consistent, made up of unwanted territorials, reservists, I used to call them the lame, the sick and the lazy. There were people who, you could hardly make soldiers of them. But nevertheless, they were in that. And of course, it all came out when we went to the 23rd Brigade, which was a pioneer brigade. It wasn't a fighting brigade. Semi-fighting, semi-pioneer.
So you had a tremendous task when you went to A Company.
So I went there. And the first time I showed up there, the captain who was there, it was an elderly chap. And I had me patrols, blue patrols on. That was just before we had to scrap him. And I reported into Durham. And when I went in, I report for duty, somewhere. I said, no, sir. I've just reported to present myself to anybody who's here and so that I'll know where I'm coming. And then this young officer came in. He was a lieutenant, tall chap. And he was leaning on the mantel shelf. And he says, oh, it's about the only time we see a sergeant major. Why they want money. And I looked at him. I don't know whether to smile at him. But and he turned out to be Lieutenant Muscrop, who became Captain Muscrop when the old man stepped out. Now then, there was a sergeant said to me, you know this sergeant? Somebody said, what? He says, these Irishmen we've got. I says, Irishmen? Aye. They had about 80 an Irishman. Oh, I says, how long have they been here? He says, oh, a long time. But he says, they've never had any home leave. I said, oh, hold on. They've got to have, no, he says, they haven't. And he says, I'm telling you, he says, because you know the battalion's moving soon, surely. I said, I know that. So I got hold of these lads, I said, come here. How long is it since you were home? Oh, I said, we've never been home since we came across. Well, weeks and weeks and weeks had been there, see. Right, I said, I went to Captain Moscrop. Who was that, Captain? By the way, sir, I says, we have men here who have never had home leave since they came here, and are due to home leave in Ireland. Oh, he said, oh, poo-poo. He put them on to fill in slip trenches, which we do. I told him, I said, look, sir, if you don't know, do something about this, I'm going to brigade headquarters, and I'm going to report the situation. Couldn't care less. And we came down to Chester Street, explained the situation, and he got immediate orders by phone to arrange leave for those men to go home. But they couldn't go for the usual 10 days. They had to go for about 3 or 4 days. But they did get leave to go home to say so long, the people say. And that was my first intimation of Moscow. I didn't like the man for his attitude in the first place. And I proved myself right when he deserted us in France when things got hot.
We'll come to that again. Who was the captain, the old elderly captain in command when you went there?
I can't think of his name.
Was he okay?
Oh, yes. Oh, he's a nice chap. Actually, we were going down to fire our course at Whitburn, and we were going to march from Durham to Whitburn, which was quite a good march. And this old chap, old man, he wouldn't be very old, but too old, or he would go with us. And we didn't get very far until we said, he's not good, and he dropped out. And actually, he said then, well, he said, this will be the last time I'll be with you, actually. And he finished. Nice old chap, been in the territorials, nice old man. But this other chap took over, and he was anything but a nice chap.
But the unit must have been pretty discontented when you got there.
I was very discontented.
How did you approach that problem? I mean, the men themselves must have been discontented as well.
It was that's what I was trying to say. See, when I got there, it was a company that was just a rabble. And this was practically applicable to the whole of the 11th Battalion. A rabble. And that's where I had to use a little bit malum. With a, fortunately, there's a couple of sergeants here. Never forget Sergeant Claude Smith. Tall lad. Been in the territorials for a long time. Nice lad. And I discovered that he was putting in duties down at a drill hall somewhere. Oh, the ballroom was here. I said to him, by the way, Sergeant, why do you go down to the drill hall? He says, oh, well, I've got to go down there, you know, so I'm in it for... I said, you haven't. You don't go anywhere but here. This is where you're stationed. Oh. Actually, he came to me to ask, would it be possible to be given leave to come in at a certain time on a Sunday morning, because him and his young woman went to church. Well, I said, there's nothing stopping you. Oh, but he said, I've got to go down to so-and-so. Well, when he told me, there was another sergeant major at another place making use of him, Claude Smith, and I went down and saw the sergeant major, and I says, no, he doesn't belong to you whatsoever, he belongs to me. And I says, he's with me now, and he stays with me. And I told Claude Smith, Sergeant Smith, look, when you go home, don't come back here on a Sunday. Go to church with a young woman, right? But I'd like to see you at 9 o'clock on the Monday. Well, he couldn't believe it. See? So you got them on your side, and they in turn worked with the men. But I told them, cut out any official action here. Let us get the men together, talk to them, tell them who they are, what they belong to, and what we expect from them. And it worked. But we never got rid of that sloppy attitude of the unwanted territorials and the reservists, why they couldn't care much less. And that was the kind of people I had. We'd be in Durham.
Whereabouts in Durham were you?
At the drill hall on Gilesgate. Gilesgate. In the drill hall in Gilesgate. There didn't seem to be any regular routine. You know, normally in a company, you know exactly what's going to happen and how it's going to happen, and you stick to that practice. But there didn't seem to be any of that. It was haphazard. It was only haphazard. I could ask, where is so-and-so? Oh, he's doing such and such. What are you doing there? I don't know. Except, say, I used to look at the board, I used to look, there's the company. There's the company. Eh? We are responsible for every name on that board. I want to know where is he. If I ask where is he, I want to know. So, if you don't mind, I want another orderly room corporal. Because the corporal is there, is just not doing his job. I'm in trouble there, is that? With the corporal not doing his job. No. If I ask you, where is number so-and-so, private so-and-so, now what do you be able to say, oh, it's such a place. Because I've got to be responsible if a colonel comes here. I must know where every man is and what he's doing. Is he sick? Is he on leave? Is he on duty somewhere else? Right? Or is he in the barracks? Well, I said, I can only do that if you keep that roster correct. So they had a hammer. And you couldn't hammer this out of the old lads that'd been at it so long, slap happy. You couldn't hammer it out. And this was the difference, where you had to more or less be rough with them, but you had to be tender with the other lads. You had to encourage them. You try to discourage this fella to get rid of him, but encourage this other fella to get him. So I did. I had a rough time. In fact, although I just lived in Burnley, I don't suppose I was home more than about twice in a matter of 3 months. You couldn't leave it. And I knew that Captain Moscrop wasn't. He'd come from some of that regiment, you know. He was a man you could not get on with. He was a man who criticised everybody and everything. But he never criticised himself. So anyhow, the time came when we said, we're moving. It's a secret move from Durham. And he couldn't get the station for mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers. Everybody in Durham knew we were moving, a secret move. And I think that was about the 23rd of April or something like that. I'm not quite sure. Excuse me.
Point, when you were moving abroad, had the overall performance of the, in your case, the company improved? Was it better than when you took over?
But you see, here was the situation. I went to a militia company, and I trained the men. Good men. I go to a territorial company, which is now embodied, of course, and you cannot train them. They know, but they don't know. And the whole thing was slipshod. And as I say, I was only home about two or three times in a matter of 3 months, and I just lived in Burnley. And my wife used to wonder where I was. I said, tell her, Ina, I cannot leave it, man. But so that's there. No, I says, I'm the sergeant major there, and unless I'm there, things can go all right, and then that'll be my fault.
What were the qualities of your platoon commanders like?
Well, as a platoon commander himself, he'll be a sergeant. When the officers themselves were the platoon commanders, lieutenants, second lieutenants, nice people. But you see, the two that I had couldn't even read a map. That's why we got astray in France. So you had to bear with them. They were still your officer, they were still your superior, but they didn't seem to have the drive. When they made sergeants into platoon sergeant majors, they knew what they were doing. because the officers who were platoon officers, they didn't seem to quite have that something. They were what I would call soft. But the symptoms of being soft and being ultra soft. Nice people, love to do their job, but respected you because of your, because they knew that you knew it. It was a case that they would ask me what they should do about a certain thing.